going to bring ourselves to order here. I wanted to express appreciation to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Justice Carpinetti, for coming over and meeting us with us. And this is an educational interaction. What we were doing is trying to share ideas, share problems, so that we all understand each other's roles. Of course, we are two separate branches of government, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have communications and understand the processes better that happen in the other branch. And I would say that I think that of the us here, I don't think we have any lawyers, do we? Oh, we have one lawyer. So, but it's interesting because most of us in the legislature don't have a background in being lawyers or that much, hopefully not that much familiarity with the court system in any other way as well. So today what we're going to be looking at is when we create laws, we hope they're clear. They're not always. And then the question is, what did the legislature intend when it put this forward? And so we're wanting the court's perspective of what that means, and we're going to then share maybe what we, you know, how we try to tell the court different things, and maybe we can get procedures established so that it becomes a clearer communication through the written law and the documents that accompany the law, so that the courts, when they are faced with a challenge, know what we were intending to do. So that's the basis for what we're doing today. Today we are cross-scheduled with a health caucus, with bringing people from rural Alaska, and a joint committee of House and Senate on mining overview. And you just can't know what's going to happen along the way, and you have to schedule these things ahead of time. So we appreciate this being recorded so that the other members can catch up with it through gavel to gavel and also through audio. There may be some questions that come up that, although the questions weren't meant to be inappropriate, it may be that the justice would be considering something too close to that in the future, and he may want to take away from that question, and we can go to hypotheticals. And so we want to recognize that there's not going to be any intent from us to evade questions from the judiciary or them from us, but that we just have to respect those different roles, and hopefully we can proceed along that way. So what we're going to do first of all is have and this again is jointly sponsored by the House and the Senate Education Committees, as an educational forum for us and the two branches. So I'm going to ask the Chief Justice to take a little while and give us the judicial perspective on legislative intent and any problems they have with understanding what we mean. So would you, and I'll let you introduce the other folks that you have with you to help answer any questions. So thank you, Judge Carpinetti.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope this doesn't sound too much like a lawyer, but I'm going to start with an elaborate disclaimer. First, I want to say that I'm speaking for myself only and not for my colleagues on the Supreme Court. I actually kind of think of myself speaking as an individual here, and not even necessarily as a justice of the court. I mean, I am what I am, but I certainly don't represent anyone else. Secondly, because this is a new procedure and we're all kind of feeling our way along, I want to make clear that to the extent that I decline to answer a question, if I do, it's because I'm just not sure that there might not be a ramification down the line that would be awkward. I suppose the quintessential case would be if I were to say something and then a legislator were to say on the floor later, well, this one's okay because the Chief Justice said so. You know, I mean, obviously it's not my role to do that. And courts have, since the beginning of our country for sure, required that there be a case or controversy before a court speaks, so that we avoid advisory opinions. So that's, to the extent that I do that, if I do it today, that's what it comes from, and not from any desire not to be helpful. So you will be able to tell really quickly that I'm working from prepared remarks, and I do that because I've kind of thought about it, so I'm pretty sure that what I'm saying is not going to be exceptionable. Maybe my colleagues will see it differently when I next see them next week, but that's the first thing. And the second thing is that I might deflect some of your questions to the two volunteer attorneys who are with me and who have agreed to be here simply for that purpose, to give a legal perspective, but not one that might be tied to a member of the court or to the court as a whole. And so let me introduce them. First on my left is Susan Cox, who's an assistant attorney general. She's the head of the tort section here in Juneau for the Department of Law, Susan Cox. And then on my right is Lael Harrison, who is a younger attorney. She is with the firm of Faulkner Banfield. I was going to say, most of you probably know Susan from her interactions with the legislature. Most of you might not know Lael at this point, but believe me, within a few years, I'm confident that you will. She's a terrific young attorney. So with that, I guess the last thing I'd say is, if it really gets worrisome for me, I'm going to reserve my right to plead the Fifth Amendment as to any question you ask me.
And I'd just like to let you know that we have some of our legislative attorneys here as well, and so it may be at some point in, again, nobody in this process is attempting to hold anybody's feet to the fire on a particular issue, but we're trying to find out procedurally how is the best communication method that works for us. So there may, you know, we may ask them at some point if we need some questions, not legal advice, but questions, we might ask them to join as well.
Great. Well, with that as a backdrop, let me go into the prepared remarks. And the text that I was given was legislative intent. What does it mean to the courts, and how do we make it clear? And because I come from a court, and because courts always go to the source, and because lawyers always define their terms, let me start with Black's Law Dictionary, a really grizzled definition. The current 7th or 8th, I guess now, edition of Black's Law Dictionary gives one short definition of legislative intent, and it is from 1812. And it is this, quote, "the design or plan that the legislature had at the time of enacting a statute." And that's a pretty simple definition, and it's pretty clear, it would seem, but those few words really hold a lot of potential problems when you get into the nuts and bolts and the nitty-gritty. So I start with the idea that the gold standard is, what did you mean? What did the legislature mean when it enacted legislation? I think most courts do. The question is, what can or should a court look at in determining what you intended? And the answer to that question is all over the board. There is a very broad sweep of opinion. I like to think of way to one side is what I think of as the Scalia view, and I will apologize right now that I was not able, in the time I allotted to this morning, to find the specific case I was thinking of when I think of it as the Scalia view. But I basically take it to be that looking to anything besides the words of the statute is essentially a fool's errand. That the legislative intent has to be discerned only from the words of the statute, because once you go beyond that boundary, you risk coming to a conclusion that the legislature as a body did not enact and that the governor did not sign. So that's one end of the scale. And I think that proceeds from the idea that anybody can, to use kind of a gross common term, anybody can lard up the legislative history with whatever they want. And what you're really worried about is a legislator who has lost a particular battle in committee or somewhere in the process, who then gets up on the floor and tries to salvage what he or she can by saying, well, what this statute really means is XYZ. And it doesn't mean XYZ in the view of the sponsor and in the view of the people that pass it through the committee and perhaps even the members who voted on the floor. So the Scalia view is, what I call the Scalia view, is look to the words of the statute, and basically that's it. The other extreme kind of has a court looking at anything that's found in the legislative history and weighing it according to one value, one set of values or another. And it could be that judge's own ad hoc set of values. I mean, there's a lot of things in legislative history, and the person who's making this determination says, well, I'll give you an example. The sponsor's statement or the governor's letter of transmittal as the highest So if something's there, that counts the most. And then maybe the next would be a committee report from the committee of origin. And then maybe the next would be a statement of supporters during the committee. Maybe the next would be a statement of supporters during the floor debate. Then maybe any statement from a legislator that can be found anywhere in the process. And I think probably everyone would agree that the lowest category in this group would be an affidavit from a legislator after a case arises saying, this is what I meant. And that's probably, there's probably not too many courts that are going to give much weight to that because, again, anybody can say what they want at that point. The other states, first of all, I don't want to pretend that I know well how other states deal with this problem, but I think it's a safe statement to say that other states are pretty much all over the map on this. And there are some states that really give little or no weight to the legislative history. Alaska law, you know, I'm biased. I think we've got a good set of principles in this regard. We're kind of a middle ground. We look first to the words of the statute. And then, if any ambiguity is found in the words of the statute, and I want to interject at this point, there's almost always going to be at least an allegation of ambiguity, or you wouldn't have a court case about it. I mean, we're not deciding this case at the Supreme Court after reviewing what a court of appeals has done, after reviewing what a superior court did, let's say, with regard to a criminal statute, if somebody didn't think there was some uncertainty as to what that statute meant. So you look first to the words of the statute. If there's any ambiguity, you apply a sliding scale, and it's this. The greater the ambiguity, the court should be more willing to look to legislative history to determine the intent of the legislature. The less ambiguity, the less willing the court's going to be willing to do that. And let me quote specifically, since I think this is an important point, let me quote specifically from our cases on this. We said in a case entitled Chalkwalk versus Worley from the mid-1990s, in interpreting a statute, the objective is to determine the intent of the legislature with due regard for the meaning that the language employed in the statute conveys to others, citing the Marlowe case from 1995. Going on with the quote, in the process of interpretation, we have, quote, rejected a mechanical application of the plain meaning rule in favor of a sliding scale approach, close quote, citing the Peninsula Marketing case from 1991. And then finally, under the approach we use, the plainer the language of the statute, the more convincing contrary legislative history must be. So basically, start with the words of the statute, determine how much ambiguity you find, and the more ambiguity, the more we're willing to go out and look at various forms of legislative history. The less ambiguity, the less willing we are to do that. So to get specifically then to your questions, the first question was, what does legislative intent mean to the courts? I think it means finding out what the legislature is trying to do with legislation. It means looking at what's the problem that you're trying to fix. It means trying to determine how the legislation solves that problem. And then, when it really comes up in the tough cases, is trying to determine what you would have intended, what you did intend, for a situation that isn't specifically expressed in the words of the statute. And so more broadly it means, how do we divine what you intended? How do we figure out what you intended? And what can we properly look to in deciding what you intended? And I think those two questions take us to the second part of the topic that you gave me for today, and that is, how can the legislature make clear its intent? I hope this doesn't sound, you know, too much like a bromide, but the way I answer that question is express on the record in a way that gets captured in that record, preferably in the minutes, what you're trying to accomplish. And let me just take a little side journey here. In this regard, I want to give kudos to the Alaska legislature for its move, I think dating back to the early 1980s, and it's certainly been implemented since then, to improve the quality of the legislative record. I think if you just do a very superficial comparison of the quality of the legislative record from the United States Congress and compare it to the quality of the legislative record from the Alaska legislature, there's no comparison. I mean, ours is much more reliable. It may be that justices like Justice Scalia want to give so little weight to the legislative history because they're dealing with what I think is a highly unreliable legislative history with the U.S. Congress. I mean, you have a situation where speeches which are not actually given and therefore not actually heard are inserted into the record and then maybe used later as evidence of what the legislators who voted on this intended. I mean, that's just with all due respect, goofy. You have the congressional record into which legislators can put items, not just speeches, but all sorts of things into the record after the legislation has been passed. And we as judges are supposed to rely on that in determining what the legislators, who probably never read that and certainly did not read it before they voted, intended. Again, I mean, that's just goofy. That doesn't make any sense at all. So, I mean, I think we're way ahead of the U.S. Congress. The Alaska legislature, my understanding is pretty much since the early 1980s, minutes are prepared of all the committee hearings. In the finance committees, we actually have transcripts, although typically we're not looking at finance committee minutes, but to the extent, I mean, what proceedings. But to the extent that you've got minutes that are well done, and hopefully the people that are doing them are doing a good job, and to the extent certainly that you have a transcript with the Finance Committee, and the fact that you have tapes for all the floor debates, plus, in my experience, a great legislative reference library and really dedicated librarians who work there, we've got a pretty good shot, at least since the early 1980s, and by this time most of the legislation we're looking at comes after that, of trying to determine what it was that you intended. So getting back to how can the legislature make clear its intent, I mean, my own personal view with regard to how to do this is, in the really basic documents, the sponsor's statement, or with regard to legislation that's proposed by the governor, the letter of transmittal, the supporting materials, studies, or accounts of a problem that come along with a legislative packet, sectional analysis, I think, is helpful. With regard to all of these items, I think it's really critical that they be updated as the legislation works its way through. I think it's not uncommon for us to find, when we're looking at legislative history, a sponsor's statement that remains the same all the way through, even though the bill goes through substantial amendments, either in the committee process or on the floor. I don't think you can really put much weight in a sponsor's statement if the bill is substantially amended. I know you have a million things to do, and I know that 90 days isn't a long time to do them, but to the extent that you're trying to tell us what you mean, I think a diligent sponsor ought to be working with his or her staff and saying, if that bill changes, we need to make sure that we've made what amendments we need to make with that regard. Same with committee reports. I know it's hard to do, and actually I don't know all the details and the ins and outs. I assume it's hard to do, but to the extent that the information that we would naturally go to is timely, it just carries more weight. To the extent it's not, we've got to guess what that difference between the two means. And then finally, I guess I'd say with regard to committee debates, I think you have to remember that if you're locked in a committee debate, an intense committee debate about the intent of the legislation, there's a good chance that the judge is going to find ambiguity about it at that time. I'm not saying don't have debates, but you know, to have some kind of closure is really helpful, I think, to a reviewing court later. Applying the sliding scale, it certainly opens up the legislation to question in a close case. Now, I know we started a little late, and I'm sure you have things to do. At this point in my notes, I was going to go through a case that I actually kind of love, and it's that Chalkwalk versus Worley case, because it's a great example of what courts do in trying to figure out what you intended. It's long and it's kind of complicated, and I won't go through everything, but just if I can take a couple minutes more.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. We've got plenty of time.
Okay. Here was the question. There was a kid who went to a party that had been hosted by a couple of young kids. Immense amounts of alcohol were apparently being served. This one plaintiff drank a lot, went out, and was involved in an auto accident, and was hurt badly for life, paralyzed. And he brought an action against the hosts of the party. And the question was, does the statute AS0421020 grant civil immunity to social hosts who provide liquor to minors? And the statute says this: a person who provides alcoholic beverages to another person may not be held civilly liable for injuries resulting from the intoxication of that person unless the person who provides the alcoholic beverages holds a license under Alaska law, or is an agent or employee of such a licensee, and the alcoholic beverages are provided to a person under the age of 21 in violation of Alaska law, or the alcoholic beverages are provided to a drunken person in violation of another statute. And the question in this case was whether that statute applied to the defendants in this case, who were not licensees, they were just private people. And I don't know how simple that issue appears to you at the outset, but we, and by we, I mean my predecessors, I wasn't on the court in 1996, went through a really long And I think exemplary analysis of what you all did. I mean, let me read a couple of key phrases. Although the phrase, quote, a person who provides alcoholic beverages, close quote, is not limited to those who are licensed to provide alcoholic beverages, Chalkwalk, that was the plaintiff and the appellant he lost below, argues that it should be construed to be so limited. Chalkwalk's argument that the legislature intended Section 020 to apply only to licensees is supported by some of the legislative history of the statute, including a section-by-section analysis. And then the court said the phrase, quote, a person who provides alcoholic beverages, close quote, employed in Section 020 is certainly broad enough to cover social hosts and other non-licensee providers as well as licensees. On the other hand, the section-by-section analysis specifically limits, as a matter of legislative intent, the coverage of Section 020 to licensees to licensees who lawfully furnish alcohol to others, close quote. And then it noted that there was other legislative history which point to the conclusion that the legislature did intend 020 to apply to non-licensees, which thus weakened the impact of the section-by-section analysis. Then the court looked at the fact that a bill that was identical in these respects had passed the legislature but had been vetoed by the governor, and in the veto message the governor explained why. And then the court took that analysis and said the governor's veto message shows that in the view of the governor and the Department of Law, the bill did apply to non-licensees. Thus, the veto message statement that the bill would significantly reduce the liability of those dispensing alcohol illegally only has meaning if the act applied to non-licensees. It used that to conclude that the section-by-section analysis was probably incorrect, and went through, considered a number of other things in the legislative history, and then came to the conclusion that, in fact, it covered both licensees and non-licensees, and therefore the non-licensee defendants in this case were able to take advantage of it and were able to escape liability. And I think this case has an example of so many different ways in which the court is confronted with legislative history and how to deal with the specific statement of the bill in conjunction and in confrontation with these various aspects of the legislative history to come to the result that it came to. Let me conclude by saying that I think a lot of the times these issues present really fascinating puzzles to a court that's later trying to figure out what it was that you were doing. And sometimes, you know, it's easy to feel like Sherlock Holmes. You want to follow the right clues, you want to disregard the false clues, and there can be false clues in there, as I mentioned before. But, you know, at the bottom, this is really the essence of democracy. What did the people's representatives intend when they passed a law that governed all of us? And I think that the stakes are really high because we both want to carry out your intent and we want to justly and fairly decide the cases that are in front of us. And you really help us by, one, drafting as clearly as you can in the first instance, and secondly, creating a clear legislative history for us to follow in the tough cases, in those ambiguous cases, maybe in cases that had not been thought about at the time but inevitably are going to come to a court to be decided. So that's basically what my pitch would be with regard to legislative history and legislative intent. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That's helpful for us, but it also puts us into a lot of myriad of different ways. And I guess what I'm taking from that is write the law as clear as you can and say as much as you can about what those things mean. I guess I'd like to start this off because we've had in the past, when I first came here, it was kind of a procedure in which we would, if a bill originated over here in the House and it was working with a subject, we would put a section in the bill on the legislative intent. This is what we intend this bill to do. And then there was a question that, well, those things are just talking and the plain word should be there. So it got to be a procedure where the other body would just strip those out and throw those away as being superfluous. And so I guess the first question that I'm trying to figure out is the legislative intent that's passed along with the bill and voted on in a House or both houses, is that then more helpful to a court than the sponsor statement or the sexual analysis, or is it just one more piece of the chaff?
Well, let me begin by saying this is going to sound like a lawyer's answer. And the answer is, it depends. And the reason I say it depends is this. My personal belief is that a statement of legislative intent at the beginning, which makes it through, should be pretty helpful. I mean, it's not just the sponsor's statement, but it is, if it makes it through the process, it's something that the members have voted on and have approved. And so I start off with the idea that a statement of legislative intent can be pretty high on this hierarchy of various pieces of legislative history. The reason I say it depends is because it's possible to have a statement of legislative intent that in some respects may conflict with the provisions of the statute itself. And the extent to which it conflicts with the provisions of the statute itself really tends to tear down the entire statement of legislative intent, in my view, because it suggests to me that if there's a clear conflict, it suggests that either the members weren't carefully looking at the whole package, or that, you know, following our basic rule, it's the words of the statute that we look at first. And if there's no ambiguity there, no substantial ambiguity, that's the end of the story. So, our court has certainly considered recently sponsored, and not just sponsored, statement of intent, and drawn a lot from them. So I think it's accurate to say that they can be very helpful in that regard. But I don't think, again, it's the end-all and be-all, because you may have a problem. And maybe Susan or Leo feels differently or wants to add anything.
I actually just happened to be doing research on that very question the other day. And I think that Justice Carbonetti summed it up perfectly, that if there's a conflict, the text of the statute will control. I think sometimes that the statements of legislative intent can be less precise than the statute. So you may have a situation where the statute lays out very clearly what to do in a specific instance, but the statement of legislative intent has a much more broad sweep that may cover situations that aren't covered in the statute itself, or that may not cover a situation that is covered in the statute itself. So to a certain extent, it'll be helpful to see what the legislature was thinking, but when it comes to looking at subpart G of part 3, they're going to go with the text of the statute.
Sure. And let me ask if any of the other legislators at this point have a question or comment that they want to interject. And we've got the mics turned up because these are, I forget whether they said it was high impedance or low impedance, but are the mics that is over at the justice's table and ours are different, so ours pick up every little scratch, so we'll try to make sure that we don't do that. I see Representative Keller, would you go ahead?
I was wondering if any distinction was made between when you're looking for legislative intent, do you put any particular weight on the sponsor's intent as opposed to the legislature as a body intent? I mean it maybe bill goes all the way through the process and then some substantive amendment happens at the last minute that may or may not reflect the sponsor's intent through the process. I mean, how do you weigh something like that?
I think that's why I made the comment about sponsor's intent being updated. Because, for example, if you have a sponsor's statement and then the bill is amended and the sponsor's statement remains the same, I think it becomes a real dicey proposition to rely on the sponsor's statement too much, unless the way in which it changed is minor or doesn't in any way impact the original sponsor's statement. So to me, it is more persuasive to have a sponsor's statement that is amended during the process or changed during the process to reflect the changes that might occur to the bill as it works its way through the process. I don't know how feasible that is, but I do know that if I'm looking at a sponsor statement that was drafted back here for a bill that looked like this, and then that bill changes, and now it looks like something very different, it's hard for me to put a lot of weight on that sponsor statement. I was just, not to be impolite, I was thumbing through these cases that I brought because I wanted to bring an example of a case in which we had used the statement of intent. And if you see me thumbing through these cases, it's, yeah, here it is. It's, this is an older case, the Linden Transport case in which I'm getting it mixed up. If I can find the case that I was thinking of, I'll bring it to your attention.
That's fine. Representative Keller.
I'll try to verbalize another question I had. It may come out more confused than, so we'll try. you said that the legislative intent language may have a broader application than what the specific law does. And in that case, I think you were saying that the intent language becomes worthless at some level. You know, I mean, not worthless, but what I mean is it could become worthless as far as determining a conflict on a particular statute. So I would assume that sometimes legislative intent can be in conflict with other portions of statute. So can legislative intent ever, I mean, is it just discounted if if there's a debate? I warned you that this might be an ambiguous question, but it seems real up here. If there's a debate, the legislative intent surely doesn't hold a lot of weight compared to, I think what you said, the specific text of the legislation itself. And then at that level, then legislative intent statement would be worthless in the context that if it's broader or conflicts with another piece of law somewhere else in statute, and you're trying to determine, make a decision based on the statute in question. Maybe I gave enough there to respond. And, I don't know.
Can you turn that mic or send the mic over and maybe you could just say your name when you start, because we got two female voices over there for our recording.
This is Lael Harrison, and I think worthless is a very strong word. I would say it would be subordinate to the precise text of the statute. I think if you had a direct conflict that was very clearly your legislative intent statement says A, but in the substantive text of the statute you're saying B, I think a court would go with B. That said, I think if you find a conflict like that, it doesn't mean that the court is going to then discount everything that's in the statement of legislative intent or will completely throw it out. I think they'll just say, in this situation where we have a direct conflict, we'll use the text of the statute, but that doesn't mean that the statement of legislative purpose is worthless or won't be looked at for another purpose. Does that address your question?
And Senator Pascal.
Thank you. I think it's always important to understand that when the issues that the justices is raising are presented to the Supreme Court, that two lawyers have been, you know, they are ethically bound to zealously represent the interest of their client, and so you have two readings that are different, and so they're banging heads all the way up until it reaches the level of the Supreme Court justices. And then that's where the process is, when you have two lawyers that are zealously representing the interests of their clients, and they're saying, I think it means one thing, and the other lawyer says, no, I think it means another thing. How do you resolve that conflict and have it apply to a very real situation? And so when the example that the justice used here was a situation is a seriously injured person trying to impose responsibility for presumably bad conduct, the question is whether the laws allowed for the imposition of liability or the application of immunity in a very real context. So just more of a comment that they understand how it gets to your level.
I had another question on legislative intent. In the situation that I kind of outlined, and of course I'm meaning this broadly, not on a specific one, but if a body puts in a legislative intent and the other body is taking it out because they think we're just talking to ourselves and we shouldn't just be talking, does the court have any adverse, shall I say, interpretation of that? I mean, is it that because the legislative intent was adopted by one body, but it didn't follow through in the other body, if it came out in committee or even on the floor or something? Is there some construction or something that the other body had to mean that they're opposed to that in opposition to saying, we're just not going to include stuff because it's superfluous? And how is there a general procedure of doing that, or is there some way that we need to indicate if we're taking something out because we think it's superfluous? Do we need to make sure that that's on the record, that it's not that we oppose what has come forward, but we just think it muddies the water?
Well, let me begin my answer by saying I'm not aware of our cases in this regard. I'm not aware that we have any cases in which we have seen an action of taking out a statement of legislative intent and then applying meaning to that. As a general principle, courts do not ascribe great meaning to the lack of action on the part of the legislature, although there are some examples. There is, for example, the situation in which the legislature passes and acts legislation, a court interprets it, and particularly when it's a close call, and then the legislature does not act over a series of sessions. It is sometimes said that the court presumes that the legislature knows what the court is doing, and its absence of action is in effect a granting of some sort of imprimatur to the interpretation that was given. But that's fairly rare, and that's, I think, on a fairly low level. I mean, to ascribe significance to the failure to do something is often kind of risky. But let me be clear that I don't know that we've had a case in which, you know, there's been a sponsor's or a statement of intent, and then it's, say, passed by one house and removed by the other body, and then we said, whoa, this means something, and here's what it means. I'm just not aware of that. I did find what I was looking for in a case that's fairly recent, Scheil versus Union Oil Company, dealing with changes that you made to workers' compensation law. And the argument that was made that I'm talking about here had to do with a statement that the changes to the law, which basically included the number of entities that could come under the workers' comp umbrella for purposes of defending, and was opposed by those that would be on the plaintiff side. And the argument was made that this violated the workers' right to equal protection under the Constitution. And one of the things that we did in trying to determine what the statute's objectives were, because that's one of the things that we look at in that kind of analysis, was statements made by the legislators during consideration of the 2004 amendments. And both sides, and various of the people that wrote amicus briefs, identified several legislative objectives through this process, and then we went ahead to look at those objectives, and we determined that they were legitimate, which is a fairly low standard to meet, but we found that they met that standard, and on that basis found that the statute was not unconstitutional. So, I mean, it's clear that, you know, as recently as this year, we're looking at various aspects of what is said about the legislation as it works its way through and making legal determinations based on it.
Good. Does anybody else have any? Yeah. Representative Foster. Before we go forward, let me just recognize, I don't think I recognize that we had Representative Gruenberg, Representative Foster, Representative Wilson, myself, Representative Seaton, Representative Keller. We have Senator Pascavan. We had Senator Wilikowski in attendance. And again, there are a number of legislators that I'm sure are going to be catching up with this when the conflicts are resolved. So,
Mr. Chairman, can I jump in for one moment?
Sure.
You know, there was some skepticism on the court for this exercise because of all the concerns I expressed at the outset. And I remember clearly saying, this has got to be a safe topic for us, because as you and I, when we first talked about this in the Anchorage airport several months ago, and I said, you know, I think that would be a great idea because I would love to ask you all questions about legislative intent. And the way this is developing, I'm not going to get a chance to ask you any questions about this.
Time's up, right?
The mic is yours.
Well, you know, I don't think of myself as a naturally suspicious or cynical fellow, but I'm dying to know, have any of you been in a situation, say on the floor, when you hear a colleague get up and say something and you say, that can't possibly be right, that's not what we intend, and you come to the conclusion that maybe somebody who's lost in a committee room or lost the debate on the floor, is losing the debate, is trying to put something in the record that a judge will 5 years later pick out of the record and say, oh, here's what this bill, am I just seeing ghosts, or does that kind of thing actually happen?
You are not seeing ghosts. I think Representative Foster and Wilson haven't been in a lot of the debates because they're new. Representative Keller or Senator Pascban, would you?
I mean, you don't have to cite chapter and verse, but I mean, does that happen?
Representative Keller and then Gruenberg. So.
Yeah, I don't have any specifics to cite, but. You know, how did you know? Of course, that's always we approach. Of course, our job is proactively trying to make policy, and so when we strive to get intent and debate in there, it has to do with whatever it is we're proactively trying to do as individuals. And of course, there's always angles that you never have considered before, and sometimes that's the beauty of the process, you know, is that the very thing that you are driving for gets, you know, in the debate, your whole plan gets messed up, and then you get this law that you guys got to deal with. But, yeah, that's always a consideration when the debate's going on. You know, what is this going to do in the court system to the law in the end? That crossed my mind often, so.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Suppose you're on the floor and you hear somebody say, this is what this bill will do, or this is what we're intending, and you think that's just flat wrong, or it's 90% wrong. Is there any sensibility among legislators that there's a responsibility to say, that's really not what this bill is doing, or is it just kind of an open free-for-all for people to kind of say what they want to say? Is there much accountability on the floor, I guess is my question.
Oh, my response, I believe there is. You know, that's what timeouts, that's what happens a lot of times in the, you know, there's a mutual respect that builds, you know, on the basis that I just said. Sometimes you just can't see all the angles, and I think it's a great process, and usually we come up with super bills. One of the most common ones, and maybe this is just in the form of another question, is that in the Constitution, it's pretty easy to say something is unconstitutional. And that can just cause, you know, all kinds of debates. And of course, the Constitution is a people's law. You know, it's meant to be interpreted by legislators and citizens and whatever, you know. So when the debate gets to that level, I sometimes wonder, you know, what that will do to what the ultimate intent of the law looks like.
Thank you.
And Representative Gruenberg, did you have on that point, or was it different?
Yeah. It happens all the time that somebody says something, and then you say, and this is in committee even more than on the floor. Gee, that's just not the way I read it, and. You can't rebut everything everybody says. And in committee or the judiciary or whatever, things are moving too fast for us to legislate with an eye at all times on how a court's going to interpret legislative history. It's pretty tough. We have an occasional letter of intent. These are getting less frequent. I remember a couple of cases, and I couldn't tell you what names they are at the present, that came out that quoted debate in the Judiciary Committee by myself, and one was Mark Handley, my former assistant. And in one case, they got it exactly right. In the other case, they got it exactly backwards. The more you say, the more you can be misinterpreted. And that's why in Congress, I think, they use committee reports a lot. And the sectional analysis is actually part of the report and is signed off on by the members of the Senate Commerce Committee or the House Ways and Means Committee or whatever. And it becomes much more weighty because it has the member's signature behind it, and it becomes a primary source of legislative history. And if there is a flashpoint or a point of disagreement, that's often the subject of minority views. And we virtually never do that here. And so you have to rely from the court on either a sponsor statement or a statement on the floor. I think all of the committees now are tape recorded. I'm not aware of subcommittees aren't. And a lot of the work, like on ethics laws and stuff that's going to get litigated, unfortunately, is done in subcommittee. And I think it's probably a good idea for the legislature, as a matter of practice, to start tape recording all the subcommittees, too. What one person says, it may reflect nobody's view but their own, and it's particularly bad in two cases. One is initiatives, where you have no legislative history at all, except for the paragraph by the people pro and the paragraph by the people con, which is virtually nothing, and these things are half the time home drafted anyway. And the other is in certain constitutional amendments, which are written so broadly that the language can mean all kinds of things, even things that are not at all within the contemplation of the people at the time, because it's going to last forever. You're not going to change the Constitution virtually ever. And then you look at sponsor statements on the constitutional amendments and things like that. But it's very tricky, and I have given some thought. I wasn't aware of how different courts in different states look at legislative history. I'm aware of how the Alaska Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals do on that various scale. But I'm wondering whether anybody, and I see we have our friends in Ledge Legal sitting in the back so they can leave quickly if they don't like what we're saying today, but that I'm wondering if anybody knows on the panel whether there are any states that have passed statutes or rules as to how legislative history should be interpreted in that state. And I like what the Supreme Court here has done, but if the Supreme Court majority changes, as we've seen elsewhere, whether they'll still use the same type of analysis. And it could go completely south if we have somebody who doesn't look at anything beyond the text on the one hand, and people who look at all kinds of things outside the text on the other. We have a small court. We only have five people. A shift in one person can change the whole way legislative history is looked at. And I'm wondering if any states have enacted statutes on how the courts should look at legislative history, what the priority should be.
I don't know the answer to that question.
And I think that we want to get back to your question to us. And I think Senator Pasquin wanted to respond there.
I think the precise question was, is if something on the floor of the body was said, and I think that it's within the context that there's a sponsor, the sponsor has enough votes potentially to get it on the floor to get it passed. There's the loyal opposition, if one wants to, you know, call it that. They can say things that are far-fetched or inapplicable, and they're saying that in the sense of trying to stop the bill or slow the bill down. So it doesn't, you know, I think that comes back to the sponsor to defend the intent of the bill on the floor.
Can I jump in?
Sure.
I agree with everything you said with regard to the setup of the question, except the last point. Not necessarily in an attempt to stop it or slow it down, but in an attempt to leave a misleading statement of legislative intent. The speaker, knowing that he or she has lost and the bill's going to pass, what can I put into the record to salvage my side of the debate, which I think is probably a really illegitimate use of legislative. I think it's gaming the system in a way that frustrates the will of the majority and confuses the judges that are later trying to figure out what that will was.
And I agree with that.
But my question is, do you think it happens?
I think the answer I said was yes.
I would say so as well. And we pretty much have a it's rare, because we are supposed to talk one time on a bill, other than the sponsor if he's answering questions. So what will happen often is there'll be somebody, you know, like you say, is on the losing side, which might try to define the issue differently than the majority is. And long debates, oh, I know that's wrong, but I'm not going to, you know, I've debated once, or I'm not going to waste the body's time because we're dragging this thing out, to get up and say that that's wrong. And I think that that's one of the big reasons why I think that this is valuable for us, to realize that it may be more important than we think to make sure that it's clear that that isn't the standing at the end, as that was the intent of the majority in passing the bill. Whatever majority that is, I don't mean, you know, majority, the working on the majority of the body that's voting on that single legislation. So I think that that's that does happen.
Thank you.
You got any other questions for us? I know
we're probably approaching the time that was set for this, and that was my burning question.
Okay, well, that was there. And Representative Keller, did you have a...
You know, if we got a few minutes, I was just wondering if anybody in the audience has a burning question, is really, really engaged, you know, I'll leave that to you. You're the chair.
Sure. Unless you are out of time, do we have any of our legal staff back there, first of all, that have some question that we should have asked and that we didn't? Yes.
I'm one of the drafters. Sometimes if there's a...
Hey, Don, can you come forward? I'm sorry about that, but we can't hear it on the record. And I've...
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity. I'm Don Bullock. I'm one of the legislative drafters. Generally, the bills that we draft now don't have findings and intent. However, an exception is made if a piece of legislation has to do with a constitutional issue in which there's a legitimate public purpose issue. We do put findings and intent in there. Does the court find that helpful, or would you rather put more weight on the discussion as the bill progresses through the committees?
I'm really reluctant to answer that question because I'm sure there's legislation going through now, and I've sort of said some things that might be construed one way or the other than that, but I think I'm going to step back and defer to my colleagues here with me, and to the extent that you ask, does the court find something, I think probably the best thing that could be said in answering it without projecting into the future is to look at what we've done in the past, and I would leave it at that.
Okay.
Anything that either...
I'm Susan Cox. And my experience in litigating the constitutionality of a statute has been regarding, it was a bill without findings, but with significant discussion along the way about whether it would be found constitutional or not, ultimately. And so we made a serious effort to make sure that we brought up all the reasons why we thought it would be constitutional in the legislative process and engaged the legislators in that debate, so we had that to present to the court ultimately down the road. But that example's the only one I can think of, and we didn't have findings per se in it, but we included information, factual information, that we felt would be supportive of findings in our favor ultimately.
Thank you.
And for what it's worth, I think the Shile case that I cited fits into that category, that parties on all sides cited various parts of the legislative history, and we certainly looked at those, and the underlying question was the constitutionality of it.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, from our perspective, I just wanted to let you know that as the bill goes through, I mean, the first committee may be having a hearing on a bill. It's going to be amended. Generally, you know, there's a number of CSs, and those discussions take place as it goes through. And so it's difficult to take and say that the one committee, if they're the only one that heard that issue, that intent, if it gets modified later, was significant, because you're looking at different wording. And so I just want to say that this has been helpful for me, anyway, to know that. Let me relate a little story. I've been told by one drafter that sometimes sponsors of bills have asked for things to be unclear because they didn't think they could get them passed if they were clear. So I personally haven't seen that.
This is my life, you know.
I personally haven't known that I've seen that. I mean, I haven't seen that, and we tried to clarify things and go down and say, well, what does this mean, and definitions and all. But the I think that what we're gaining from this is a perspective that we ought to be as clear as we can in the wording of the statute. And if there's ambiguities, we ought to at least clear those up on the record in our committee, as in the very narrow sense of what does this word or what does this paragraph mean, and how will it be applied, so that there's an explanation of that. And that further legislative intent that's voted on by the bodies is probably more helpful than just discussion in committee. And if I'm misinterpreting what I'm hearing as that level, I would like to, you know, have you state, but if that's just a general proposition, that those are the kinds of things that would be helpful in expressing our intent when at the time we're passing something, I'd just like to kind of wrap that part up. Representative Gruenberg has something else, but I just does any other legislator? Okay, so we're all kind of putting arms around that kind of an issue. And a way of trying to clarify what we mean. And yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Something else. This is a very, very tricky area, legislative history, from the point of view of the judiciary, particularly in a small new state like Alaska, where we don't have lots and lots of time and debating the same issues and permutations. And legislation, initial legislation passes, and then you get a second generation of fix-it legislations, or bringing it up to date with new technology or whatever. And other states have gone through this, but we haven't had the time to do that here. Another issue, though, that you really have to know from the court point of view, that you'll never know unless you look very carefully at the hearing record, is who has been there to talk about the bill? Most of the time, because we're so far from Anchorage and people are just not very aware, we don't get much testimony. And there's the bill sponsor, and maybe nobody else testifies. Maybe the person who wants it. Maybe no questions at all. But that doesn't really explore the place where the rubber's going to meet the road, because it's going to be at those flashpoints that you have to have both sides represented to really know what, how these issues should be interpreted much later in a court setting. And it's particularly a problem, and I'll put this on the record here, in committees now, because traditionally now the public defender and the OPA don't testify on the merits of bills. We only hear from the prosecution. And so you need to look very carefully. If you're looking at this period of time, since this practice has come about, we are only generally getting one side of the story. And be very careful before you just accept things at face value, unless you look at the witness list and see if all these issues have been fully explored, because a lot of them aren't.
Well, and just to be on the other side, you know, we do have full public notice, and almost always we try to have two hearings on a bill to give the public time to comment on those things. So I'm not going to be as enthusiastically endorsing the opinion that, you know, you're only hearing one side in these, because we also ask a lot of questions about the bills, trying to understand them before we pass them, at least, you know, most of us do. And so I would look to the questions that the committee members ask, because you have, you know, a proportional representation politically and everything else on the committees as well. So I think that that's going to be our charge as legislators, to make sure that we ask the questions on the bills that we see. So anyway, we are, was there anyone else that had a question that we need to kind of look at? And Judge, I'd like to say that I really appreciate you coming, and if we put you on the spot on anything, these things, we will interpret your answers as your personal answers and not representing the court, but that your perspective, having, you know, that experience will help us, I think, form better bills that will have better our intentions shown as time goes on. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. That would be wonderful if it happened. And in any event, it's been a real learning experience for me, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you from all of us.